Okay, hello everybody. I'm Ajahn Subbaro, and I'm recording this as an MP3, kind of starting right now, and I'll be putting this on my website, bhikkhu.ca. And by the way, I'm really pleased that my dad was able to come tonight. Thank you, Dad. And okay, so tonight I want to answer five simple questions. And this is just like a real summary of kind of who I am and what I do and why. Okay, so these are the five questions. Okay, what's my name? What do I do? Who do I do it for? What do those people want and need? And how they change as a result? Okay, I'm going to attempt to answer these and answer them concisely. Okay, so what's my name? Ajahn Subbaro. What do I do? Teach meditation and Buddhism. Who do I do it for? Buddhists who have a Westerner background. And what do those people want and need? Peace of mind. To go to a heavenly rebirth when they die. How do they change as a result? Well, it's kind of the same thing. They become more peaceful. They become more relaxed, more centered, more grounded, more... their morality improves. Their generosity improves. And they create the best conditions for good things happening in the future. Okay, so now I'm going to kind of drill down a little more into each of those questions. Okay. So hopefully if we were on an elevator together, I would have been able to say that by the time the elevator ride was over. Okay, that's my elevator speech. And all right, now... let's unpack this a little more. So my name, Ajahn Subbaro, what does that mean? Ajahn is the honorary kind of title, meaning teacher, which is used in the Buddhist tradition that I'm ordained in. I come from a Theravada forest tradition from Thailand, meaning the monks live in the forests, or at least the vast majority of the time they live in the forests and forest monasteries. And Subbaro is the name my teacher gave me, and Ajahn Sona. And okay, what is it that I do? What it is that I do is teach meditation and kind of the worldview which that is couched in, which I would call kind of the religion of Buddhism. There's a worldview which comes along with all this meditating, and there's a lot of nuances to it. It takes a long time to kind of explain all that. And, and who do I do it for? Westerner Buddhists. Westerner here means they speak English. They probably live in countries such as Canada, the USA. You never know, maybe the UK. Because this is on the internet, they could search for terms just like I've been speaking and find this. Or really any of the English-speaking world where you find Buddhists. I was just in Malaysia, and the people kind of my age, kind of middle-aged, the Chinese Malaysians, they too speak English. And they're Buddhist. And I still have some contacts there as well, by the way. What do those people want and need? Okay, well, I can't really read their minds, but I'm going to guess. Okay, so I think what these people want is they live a very fast-paced, usually, a very fast-paced and almost chaotic life. They feel a little like the world, you know, their lives are too busy. They would like to try to slow things down, but it's hard to. They would like to simplify their lives, but it's hard to. We live in a culture which is going to push us in the opposite direction at pretty much every turn, you know, always trying to turn up the dial, to a little more activity, a little more involvement, engagement, you know, doing things, going places, buying things, acquiring things. We live in a culture which kind of pummels us from every direction to do that. And it actually takes concerted effort to sort of go in the other direction. So I'm one of those rare people who will kind of cheer you in that opposite direction of actually simplifying, actually slowing down, actually bringing one's life into a more grounded, stable place emotionally and spiritually. Okay, so I think what people want and need is more emotional well-being, more happiness, more calmness, better relationships with others, better communication, just all around good vibes. And most Westerner Buddhists, they oftentimes will come to Buddhism because of the meditation specifically. They've heard about some of these deeper states of mind, such as metta or loving kindness, or the other Brahma viharas. They've heard of serenity. They've heard of equanimity. They've heard of compassion. They've heard of mudita, sympathetic joy. They've heard of these, and you know it's quite a wonderful thing to touch upon these, because this is said to be the very stuff of what it's like to be an angelic, godly like being while still in a human body. So I think that's what they want, and as they approach meditation. And there's deeper meditations as well, the so-called samadhi or jhanas, sometimes called the absorptions, sometimes called concentration. There are several words to call this, but this is also very desirable. And then also stages of enlightenment. There's full arhantship, and then there's as well stages of enlightenment leading up to that. Sotapanna, Sakadagami, and Anagami, stream runner, once returner, and non-returner before arhant or fully enlightened being. So this is what people want. Okay, that's my guess as to what Westerners want from Buddhism. And I'm also going to qualify it that what they want at the same time is to retain all of the wonderful benefits which Western thinking brings along with it. This is in counter distinction to, let's say, more kind of traditional old world values, kind of more medieval values. Values which we as Westerners also had, if you go back in time, even so much as like 600 years ago and older. We too were sort of in a medieval time, medieval thinking. But, you know, that all changed there. Yeah. Anyway, so we think much more rationally now, more scientifically, more logically, more, you know, in a linear kind of analytical way. And that's brought us a lot of benefits, which we would not like to lose. We like proof. You know, we like the areas of Buddhism which are provable. And I just listed them. Things, you know, these meditations can be accomplished, and one can experience them directly. Then one can feel that proof of having touched on it and felt it. Okay, but the more traditionally Buddhism comes with some, shall we say, worldview things which require quite a leap of faith to believe in, things which kind of come from the cosmology which was prevalent at the time of the Buddha. There was a wide pantheon of deities at that time, which like everybody believed in. I mean, like everybody. Westerners are very reluctant to accept this on faith. That's cool. So they would prefer to not have to go back to medieval thinking, yet at the same time obtain all the benefits of these Brahma Viharas, of these jhanas, of these stages of enlightenment. They're like, you know, give me the Nibbana, but hold on the medieval mindset, please. You know, and all that which comes with it. So I believe that is what Westerners kind of are looking for. How do they change as a result? Well, it is a long and gradual process usually, but how it changes is we indeed tune into our hearts a lot more. We tune into morality a lot better. We tune into having a much more clear sense of right and wrong. And that can be very context specific sometimes. You know, sometimes a certain activity just isn't right to do, maybe at that time or that place. But in another time and place, it's okay. You know, morality, I think, over time, one will develop a more mature attitude where one knows the right thing at the right place and time. You know, like there are some areas of morality which are, you know, kind of set in stone. You know, it's always good to do such and such, or it's always bad to do such and such. But there are some areas where, well, there's sort of appropriate context, okay? And when we tune into our hearts will tell us loud and clear, now is a, don't do that now, wrong, you know, or, oh yeah, that's okay now. And it's okay with it. So we tune into this and it makes our relationships way better. We make way less mistakes when we can read those situations more, accurately and, you know, like our heart is more connected to nature, it's connected to each other, it's connected to, it takes into account so many factors. Okay, so that is how we would change as a result, is we get more in touch with our hearts, we become more moral, we make better choices, we secure a better future for ourselves because we have created good conditions where, you know, the good resultants are bound to come sooner or later. And if somehow or other, we don't quite maybe know how, but it is a sure thing in Buddhism that when you do good things, good results come in the future. And if you do bad things, it is sure that bad results will come in the future. So that cause and effect relationship becomes far more clear to us and becomes, we accept it far more first on faith, and then we see the proof of it later too. Okay, so that is kind of my little elevator speech. So maybe I'll just say a few more things along those lines as well. That actually went a little faster than I thought. Right, so here I am at the Canmore Theravada Buddhist community, which is now being, formally sort of talked about in as being a monastery. I've been invited to be the senior monastic teacher here. So we do three teachings a week here. I do this one on Tuesday. Then there's one on Saturday, which I do, but it's not in Zoom. It's in another app called VLC. And then I can accept feedback in this kind of chat thing I set up called Mattermost. It's a bit like Zoom, but it respects your privacy. And I've got it rigged up in a real nice way where even after I talk for a whole hour, it just saves a real nice small video file that's only like 200 megabytes. And then I quickly upload that. It's on my website within 15 minutes of the of when I press stop. So it's real low maintenance. I'm not doing video editing. I'm not doing, you know, because that's kind of a lot of effort I would prefer not to get into if I could help it. Anyway, and then there's also a Friday. There's also a Friday morning group. Right now, Mary is leading that group. She's been leading these groups for, you know, way over 20 years now. I'm not quite feeling up to doing all three of these teachings just yet, but it might happen yet. Just maybe give me another month or something. Let me think that over. So that's kind of what we're doing these days, primarily to connect with the Buddhist in this community and the surrounding regions. And there used to be, before COVID-19, there used to be quite a group who would come here to meditate all together. And, you know, we're optimistic to kind of do that again when we can. Yeah, and Now, as a monk, I do not handle money. I don't have a bank account, and this place is supporting me. And I am getting alms food every day. Mary's cooking it, but pretty soon here, I'm going to be getting alms food from others offering it as well, and even going walking to other people's houses to collect the food with my alms bowl. So I am, and you could say, an alms mendicant. I live off the donations of food from others. I can't cook for myself under the monk rules I follow in this tradition. And so there is this sort of back and forth relationship between myself and the Buddhist community. Primarily I offer teachings, and I hope to receive in return. I cannot directly ask for it, but it would sure be nice if I could continue to be provided with the things I need. Basically, it's food, clothing, shelter, medicine. Those are the so-called four requisites. Money's not one of them. I don't have a credit card. So that's I'm placing quite a bit of trust and faith that Canmore and the surrounding regions are a, you know, there are enough Buddhists, there are enough people interested. Maybe not formally part of the Buddhist religion, but they are, you know, amenable and willing to support a monastic like me. And so that's kind of what we're doing here. And I've only been here a month, so things are kind of still in early times. By the way, we're looking for a male steward to come live here at present. What else can I say? Oh, well, that's a pretty good summary. You know what, the question and answer period sometimes feels a little rushed, and normally that isn't for like another, 10 minutes from now, but I kind of want to stop my talk here and leave a little more room for questions this time, because the time kind of ran out last week. There were some really good questions and I couldn't quite get to them all. So I guess I'll just turn it over then. Are there any questions out there? Okay. Well, a lot of monks like me would want to give you some sort of objective meditation, which you could try to practice more regularly and, try to do it whenever you can remember to. Now, if you're anything like me, like back in my lay life, I lived a really kind of busybody kind of life, and it was very hard to remember to meditate. Like, I would always just have something or other on my mind, which, would always just kind of overpower me, you know what I mean? And If you can find an object of meditation which works for you and is able to sort of retain your mindfulness and kind of keep you, as long as it works, as long as it actually, you're able to stay with it and it's comfortable, then I say yes, to do it. The most common ones that are taught by the Buddha would be mindfulness of the body or mindfulness of your breath. Or if you're very creative, both of those. If you can handle it, yes, both is also okay. And now that's very standard advice you'll hear from just about every monk. I'm going to add something a little different, saying what I've observed in all the years I've been a monk is there is a rather important thing here as well, which makes a real big difference. At least for me, it makes a huge difference about just how kind of squirrely my mind gets and how busy it gets, how full of thoughts it gets. There are certain things I do in my life which don't really make too much of an impact on my mind, like a lasting, staying impact on my mind. But then there are some other things, maybe I care more deeply about it, maybe there's some issue or other that I'm really kind of into and I care about, And it's something that I, you know, kind of feel passionate about, or I feel very concerned about. It tends to be those like high concern, high passion sort of things, I find anyway, which stick in my mind more. So I guess what I'm inviting you to consider is, what is it in your life which tends to really stick in your mind, okay? And stick in a mind that stick in your mind in a way that you just don't feel is really helping you. It's like overthinking, you know what I mean? What things tend to be in your mind which is kind of like overthinking? It's not really helping much. It's just kind of, it's almost like the gears are grinding a little more than they need to, you know? And what causes and conditions get those gears in motion? And what causes and conditions get those gears kind of grinding a little more than you would like? And that takes a little honesty, and it takes some humility to kind of admit that. Because oftentimes it's stuff, you know, we're quite passionate about and we like it. Like it's not likely we're going to want to give that stuff up easy because we're passionate about it. We like it. So, but if we do some very honest and careful, taking stock of what it is we're allowing into our lives, what sorts of issues, what sorts of people, what sorts of places are we going? Like, what sorts of websites are we visiting? What sorts of TV shows are we watching? This sort of thing. And then let's be honest about just how much that sticks in our minds when we're done with those. And, you know, we move on to the next activities later on in our day. So, you know, I guess what I'm inviting you to consider is, if you can either cut down on those things or curtail them a lot, you know, or possibly even eliminate them if they're not helping you really, if you're honest with yourself, that goes a long way to making your life a lot more peaceful and a lot more settled down, such that it's not so hard then to have an object of meditation. You know what I mean? Like if my mind is wound up to, you know, 70 miles an hour on some issue, it's going to be very, very hard for me to stick with any object of meditation. Like, it'll just be torn away. It'll just be torn away by that momentum of those thoughts that I got all whipped up. So if I were to have more wisely maybe avoided whipping my mind up into a 70 mile an hour wind, you know, if I could have just, you know, maybe an hour ago or a day ago or whatever, just maybe not talk to a certain person if I didn't need to, or maybe I could have avoided looking at some website which really kind of presses my buttons or something, you know. Maybe I don't need to watch a certain TV show which really is going to stick in my mind, the imagery or something, you know. Like, it is by kind of avoiding those sorts of things which leave that impression that we don't really want left there, that goes a long way to making meditation so much easier. Now we actually stand a chance, much better chance, of retaining our mindfulness and sticking with our breath, sticking with our body, like whatever it is we're going to undertake as our object of meditation. So, you know what I mean? Like, there's wisdom to be applied here. It's not just about meditating. There is wise consideration about what it is we do in our lives and how that affects us. How does that leave us feeling afterwards, you know? That we must take stock of it, you know? The Buddha gives a very nice simile about a shopkeeper. He likens this to somebody running like their own little store, their own little shop, who sells things. And a wise shopkeeper, you know, if he's going to run a successful business and make a good profit, he has to be smart about just how much each of the items cost, you know, what are his costs, you know, for the items he puts for sale, and then how much does he sell them for? And, you know, what kind of profit does he get off of that sale? What kind of commission, what kind of percentage does he get off of that sale? And he has to be a wise shopkeeper who also watches out for thieves who are going to steal things out of the store as well. So he has to be kind of a shrewd businessman to make a profit. So that, to me, that what that analogy is trying to teach us is like, yes, you know, try not to get lost in thoughts which distract you away from your object of meditation. Those are like the thieves who come in your store and steal things. You know, like it's your object of meditation which will be stolen by your stray thoughts. If you don't watch, you have to watch. That's mindfulness. But then there's also this shrewdness around, like, you need to know how much things cost in your life and what kind of profit you get from those things. So that's like, you know, whatever you decide to bring into your life, what does that really cost you? You know, what sorts of activities you undertake, what sorts of things you might buy, or what people you talk to, what's the cost to that really? Like an emotional cost, a spiritual cost. What does that cost you? And does it really benefit you? What do you actually get out at the end in the sense of increased emotional well-being or more peace of mind or more happiness or all these good things? So that's kind of the profit which the shopkeeper gets. So we should know what things cost us spiritually and you know, emotionally, and what profit do we get spiritually and emotionally. So that's what a wise shopkeeper would do. So that analogy, I think, is a great summary of what I just said, in addition to having an object of meditation, like the breath or the body. So that's my answer. Okay, so well, we're within the last 10 minutes before we end. I also do a show on Saturday night, or a Dhamma Talk, video. It's in VLC. I left a link which in the chat here, if anyone wants to sign up for a user on my little chat server, you can ask questions or give feedback, even just like a smiley face or a thumbs up. Those are really nice to see in there. And I can see who's online. Like, I can see little green circles for the people who are actually online. More details at my site, bhikkhu.ca. There's also kind of a news item on the CTBC website leading you there as well, about Saturday night Dhamma talks. So, I also I'm willing to receive questions over email. I have email address set up just for that. It's qa@ebt.support. So anything I talk about involving this ebt.support, that's a domain which I run. Like, that's, same with the Mattermost server. You're going to see ebt.support in that URL. That's, you can trust that URL. That's not a hacker website. That's a website I run, and I set it up totally. It's highly, highly likely to be trustworthy and safe and everything. So, so that's my little plug for the Saturday night show. And then of course there's the Friday Zoom as well, which Mary is at present also doing. That one's in the morning. I want to say thanks to everyone who came. Let me just kind of see here. There's like 12-ish people who came. 13. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So much appreciate everybody. And, if there's no further comments or anything, you know, real quick, we'll just move to kind of the closing homage and wrap it up. And anything on your side, Mary, that you'd like to mention or... Yes, that the early Buddhist texts are the portion of the Theravada Pali Canon, kind of like the Bible of Theravada Buddhism. The early Buddhist texts are the portion which the historians and academics, who are Westerners, believe to be the original, most original, oldest Buddhist teachings. So those are my favorite, and I tend to read those the most by far, and my teachings will virtually always draw upon those, as opposed to commentaries which came centuries later. They're still good, but they're just not the early Buddhist texts.